March 16th, 2017, Masoret. So we were discussing the concept of the Kruvim, and the Kruvim are part of the Kaporis. The Kaporis is the covering of the Ark. And we took up the idea of the Sephorno, and that is that it sort of depicts, it's an angelic image, and the way I understand what he's saying is that that really is the way, what man ought to aspire to. Of course, the angels are with the wings pointed towards heaven, which indicates the idea of getting closer to Hashem. And the angels are intellectual beings, and man too, even though he's not intrinsically or exclusively intellectual, he's a very strange type of a being because he partakes of the instinctual as well, but he has to separate himself from that, and the way to do so is through the Torah. That's where the Torah comes into the picture. It is via the Torah that man transforms himself from an animalistic existence into a intellectual existence. That's a brief summation of what we read so far. In this Sephorno. Then we took up the idea, he mentions this, that according to the Gemara, they were male and female. And we're trying to figure out the significance of that. And I wanted to say, you know, tangentially, on the basis of like drush, but I thought it was more of serious drush, and that is the idea of male and female would indicate that, you know, that there's no real difference, that God created the human, male and female created he them, and both of them have this potential. The man and the woman have this potential. So we don't recognize any supremacy of gender, just as we wouldn't recognize, you know, race and all these other ethnic, all of these other differentiations that people make, and whether they utilize them in a positive way or whether they're in a negative way. So people take these things, which basically are really accidents, color, race, things of that sort, and elevate them into matters of importance. That's a big problem in the world. That, of course, essentially causes division. That causes division and hatred. Just, it seems, because any time you have a certain factor like that which differentiates you, so then, you know, you have two groups. So one group feels superior, the other group hates them and looks at them as being inferior. And in general, it causes tremendous dissension. And it's a false thing. The principle that people should adhere to with regard to all other people, you know, people of different, diverse characteristics, is that they're all non-essential. The essence of man, see, the essence of man is depicted essentially as a kruv. It doesn't have any kind of a color or a ethnicity or race and things of that sort. Because the essence is really what the Torah is saying. If the whole world went back to that pasuk, you wouldn't have these problems. Because the pasuk says that God created Adam, Betzalmo, in his image, and the Zachar and Akeva Bara Osam. That's all. It doesn't say anything else about all the other factors. So all the other factors that come into play over the course of time are purely accidental. That's not what defines you as a human being. Now, I couldn't help thinking, and this is really going off the track, but while I guess it's the rabbi in me that I guess if I just thought of a little drasha I could give at a chuppah, because I've given different drushas at chuppahs over the years. I'm not saying I'm going to that. I don't really perform weddings. I don't have a chance to perform weddings anymore. But I was thinking also, and I guess this is really drush, that it's the male and female, so there's a concept of, that's also an important idea, the relationship between the male and the female. And that's a necessary element of human existence. And what I could say, I'm not saying I would, but you see that they're looking, both of them are looking at, they're gazing at each other, right? One is looking at the other one, and both of them are pointed towards the Torah. So it's just a drushy idea that that is a, it's interesting because if you want to apply it to the relationship, so the relationship is based upon the attraction to each other, but it only really attains success, so to speak, if it's rooted in these ideas. So the ideas of Torah then are essential in terms of establishing a harmonious kind of a relationship. Not enough. Well, you see that the idea I'm saying is a true idea. Whether that it's whether it's appropriate to associate it with the Kruvim because one is male and one is female, that I'm not sure about. But I definitely could do so for purposes of description. Of course, you know, you can't just get up and say an idea. You have to root it in something which is in the Torah. So that, you know, it's a tremendous problem today in terms of the divorce rate, in terms of the breakdown of marriage, the breakdown of relationships. And this is, I mean, there's many reasons, but this is a factor in that if it's merely based upon the emotional attraction, physical attraction, emotional attraction, what they call chemistry and so on and so forth, that seems as it's not enough because these things sort of wear off over time. And also, a big enemy of marriage or a big enemy of any kind of institution and relationship, because the relationship implies a certain yielding of the selfishness. If you're going to be in a relationship, you can't be totally selfish because what about the needs of the other person? So each party has to sort of sacrifice a certain amount of the selfishness. But the selfishness is in conflict with the union. And what happens is in an age like our age, when there's so much of an emphasis on self-gratification and narcissism, I mean, the whole idea of the significance of, you know, a social unit, the whole idea of the significance of a social unit, it really is diminished. Like people, the idea of patriotism to this generation doesn't have the same importance that it had to the older generations, because it's like they look at what about it's a great country and this and that. But today the way I sense it, I mean, I haven't done a exact study, I sense it's important only if it satisfies my needs, as long as it satisfies my needs. But they don't really have a feeling about America, that there's something great about it and it's worth preserving. And even if it's not satisfying my particular needs, I could look at things in an objective light. I can value things that have objective importance, even though they're not gratifying me at this moment. So that's a big problem. And I think it carries over into all areas, and I think it carries over into marriages. That a person is more reluctant, I would say, in the past. I mean, of course, there's the social factor of the taboo. There used to be a taboo against divorce. And you know, you can decide whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. It did keep the number of divorces much, much lower. When now that there's absolutely no taboo at all, so it produces this result, because people have less to fear on every level. Even in the religious communities, I don't think a person is, you could correct me if I'm wrong. What's it like in the, maybe in certain religious communities, It's a bit of a, even in the most frum, where I assume the divorce rate is probably less. It's because of the factor of the social. But I don't think it's like considered the tragedy that it was at one time, and you know, the ostracism and so on. Certainly in the ordinary Jewish community, and I'm talking about the religious community, I'm talking about the modern Orthodox, I don't think it's considered to be such a terrible thing. Correct me. What would you say about that, Libby or Jesse? It's very hard to say it is, because the numbers are so high. It's when something becomes widespread, so then it can't be. You can't condemn. Who are you going to condemn? You look in your own family. I mean, this whole thing with off the derech, with, you know, students who've been raised religiously going off the path and not keeping. It's become so prevalent and widespread that nobody can condemn it, because you just look in your own backyard and you'll find, you know, if it's not your own immediate family, it's people that are close to you. So it's interesting that it doesn't mean that there should be. See, the taboo has a negative as well. The taboo has a negative in that there are couples that really have very good reasons to divorce, and it's a miserable marriage. So there's in such a case, there's no reason why people should be miserable. So, but the taboo prevents you. I mean, it's a conflict. So that shouldn't be there. I mean, people should have the freedom to remove themselves from a bad relationship in order to enter into a good one. But at the same time, it provides a social benefit. But I'm just saying over here that given that that's the factor, the idea of gazing at the Torah really is a beneficial thing in terms of maintaining the relationship, marriage, but not just, you know, family and so on and so forth, because it's essentially rooted in ideals. It's not just a matter of the personal attraction, which over time is going to, things are going to get bumpy. It's not in and of itself, it's usually not enough to sustain. But if two people are joined because of an ideal and they're working together to achieve an ideal, which is the Torah. All right, I just wanted to throw that out there. I think it's a nice thought, and I think it's a nice image if you're giving a little talk under the chuppah. Anyways, but I don't think that's really the primary level of what's going on over here. The primary level in terms of the Gemara, which says that, you know, one was male and one was female. Okay, so let's take a look at how the Sforno understands it. So he says, now our sages have said that the Keruvim were male and female, indicating the action of delivering or giving the general principles of truth and apprehension removed from the physical, which is akin to the action of the male, who conveys, as well as indicating receiving these principles which are removed from the mundane, akin to the function of the female. So he's approaching it in a completely different way. In other words, he's translating it as expressing and representing the masculine and the feminine. Again, these things are just generalizations. It doesn't mean that only men are the actors and perform the actions, and women are passive. That's not what it means. However, in terms of representation, the Torah is choosing, because maybe in general that's the way it is, or has been throughout history. Our era is very, very much different in terms of the role and the activities of women. It's unique, because by and large, you'll find women in virtually every type of activity and profession, professionals, lawyers, doctors, even in the military. And in the military, not performing necessarily the traditional roles. But even, because that was, traditionally women in the army weren't involved in combat. So they did pretty much the same type of services and activities that women did in civilian life, except it was for the purpose of the army. But they didn't get into tanks. And, and engage in combat. And they didn't fly airplanes, warplanes. But that is basically changing. And the Israeli army was pretty strict about that also. That just like the men, all the women in Israel are conscripted, have to serve in the army. But again, it was supporting kind of roles. And they didn't do the actual combat. And even Israel is loosening up on that, because I think that they're also permitting women to be involved in combat and in the Air Force. Now, of course, the question is whether that's a good thing or not. So I think it's too soon to tell. It's brand new. My personal attitude on women's rights, so to speak, is that I'm very, very liberal on that. I mean, if a woman wants to be, especially even though the traditional role is to get married and have children, first of all, that itself doesn't preclude being involved in other things. Perhaps part-time while you're raising the kids, but once the kids are raised, you could, go back into the workforce full-time. I think it's a good thing that a woman has the opportunity to use her talents, to use her skills. Because that's a very fulfilling thing in life. And we see their doctors and so on and so forth. And I personally don't have any sense of discrimination. If I'm going in for a test or I'm going referred to a doctor, it doesn't matter to me if it's a male or a female. And I would say, how far would you go for a woman? I mean, I'm not taking into consideration all the military considerations, what effect that's going to have. That's a different story. That's for the military to decide. But the idea of a woman wanting to learn how to fly and flying a warplane and so forth, fine. I have no problem with that. But as I said, that remains to be seen. A lot of these things remain to be seen in terms of whether it's going to work out practically and its effect on the society in general. That nobody can predict. Nobody knows. It's just too soon to tell because this is pretty much new stuff. So therefore, I mean, that's been the traditional idea that the male represents the actor, action, the active. And the woman represents reception, so to speak, or passivity. Obviously, a man can be passive and a woman can be active. It's just a question of a representation. But what this Forno says, so what does it have to do with the what does it have to do with the Kruvim? What does it have to do with the Torah? It seems, the way I understand it, is that in order to attain, I think he's sort of talking about there's two functions. I'm going to explain it, I think, on two levels, which are pretty close to each other. Because there's two functions. There's the function of teaching, of trans. I think that's basically how Rabbi Pelkowitz understands it. I would like to read, when we're finished with this, I would like to read his notes on this particular part. There's the act, in other words, in gaining the Torah, so you have to transmit, that there's the transmission of the Torah, the act of transmission. That's an activity. You have to study it, and you have to actively transmit, you have to teach, and everything that's associated with the activity of teaching. And I think that's what he's referring to. Indicating the action of delivering, okay, in parentheses, or giving the general principles of truth and apprehension. That's the activity. And then you have the reception, that the one who's receiving has to be, is not, that's not considered to be an action, that's considered to be passive. You're receiving something. So those are the two activities that are pertinent to the Torah. In order to perpetuate Torah, to keep Torah alive, one has to, it requires two things. It requires the activity of transmitting, and it requires the passivity, so to speak. It's not truly passive, because you are, it's not just that you're not doing anything, but you're listening, and you're receiving, and you're accepting. But that's referred to as the feminine, receiving, reception. So you could take this idea a little bit further then. And that is that in order for a person to really gain the utmost in their development, as far as Torah is concerned, it requires thinking. You have to think, you have to be creative, you have to be active. You need the fact that you can't just be listening and merely accepting everything like a sponge. You have to question, you have to challenge, you have to think, you have to apply it. It's got to become your Torah, so to speak. So it definitely involves the use of the mind, and it definitely involves activity. Okay, but that's one aspect, but there's another aspect in which you simply have to receive. And there's areas of the Torah where you really may not comprehend. And you just have to have the ability to accept that which is being taught to you. And things in the Torah that are beyond your grasp, that are beyond your comprehension, but you have to receive them. So that ability to everything, even the areas where you can gain an understanding, but the student first has to be capable of listening and accepting and hearing. Okay, that's how it starts. So if you don't have that capability, you can't do that, then you can't proceed. At the same time, you also have to have the ability to become active vis-a-vis the things. In other words, you shouldn't just remain in that state. Like if you have, let's give an example, let's say like cult leaders or a cult-like group, even if it's a Torah group, where they have this great figure or this powerful, the Rebbe, the teacher. So, the students, so to speak, they just become receptacles because he overpowers them. So they're just, but it never gets beyond that point. It's just the reception. And they can't challenge, they can't question, they can't disagree. So then they're lacking in the capability of action. You have to have the capacity for action. You have to have both. If you don't have the capacity for reception, then you can't really gain anything in the world of Torah. But if it's purely one of reception, and you don't have the capability for action and active intellect, that is to think for yourself. The ability to think for yourself, to challenge, to question. It goes back to the Torah. You see that Avraham challenges Hashem, so to speak, by Sodom. And how can you do such a thing? How can you do such a thing? I would say, by the way, now that I think about it, is that the case of Avraham would illustrate both of these things. Because we find him in two, we discussed it. We find him in two different ways. We find him in terms of action. That's the classical question. The difference between the behavior of Avraham with regard to Sodom and with regard to the Akedah. With regard to Sodom, he's extremely active. And he's challenging. He's not... You don't see that acceptance. And of course, of course, he accepts. Doesn't mean that he thinks God is making a mistake. That's not the point, as we've explained many times. But it's an opportunity for Avraham to gain an understanding. But in the course of doing so, it's like he's arguing. That's the action. There's no way that I can learn. I mean, if Avraham can challenge Hashem, so certainly a student can challenge his Rebbe. But there's no way that I can gain unless we set it up as a debate, even with God. And I know God is right, but right now I'm assuming the posture of a challenger. So that's action. However, in the case of the Akedah, there's no action at all. He's totally passive. And he's receiving, because that's not an area. There are areas that are open to action and the attempt to make sense out of it. And then in that situation, that's what you have to do. It's got to make sense to you, because you're not really learning anything. If you just heard this very convincing teacher and you just accept it because he sounds so convincing, but you can't defend it and you can't explain it, so you don't really understand it. So if you don't understand it, you really didn't learn anything. That's not learning. Learning means to understand it. And then there's a situation where it calls for passivity. He received. He didn't challenge. He didn't question. He received because he realized this is an expression of the divine will. It has nothing to do with justice or anything like that. And it's not subject to understanding. But here it's a test. Okay, that's how I understand what the Sforno was saying. That and both. So therefore, to depict both of these types of postures, the one of activity and the one of reception. So one of them is depicted as a male, one as a female, and both are needed. Okay, that and their eyes are towards the kaporis. In other words, indicating that this is how you relate to the Torah. Okay, so let's read it again. Which is akin to the action of the male who conveys, as well as indicating receiving these principles which are removed from the mundane, akin to the function of the female. And the verse also says, okay, so now he's going to take up the next thing, Ufneim ish alachav. They're facing each other. So that also conveys a certain idea. With their faces one to another, what does that convey? See, he's conveyed a lot so far, this Sforno. He's explained the Kruv itself, what it represents, the angels, and how that concept relates to human existence. He's explained the wings and why they're pointed upward. And he's explained the fact that it's male and female. Now, what's the idea of facing one another? Say that it's basically depicting the activity of Torah study. And that relates to the Gemara says that it's not good for a person to learn by himself. And that a person should learn with a chavrusa. It has cherev al habadim. All right, it's a play on words. It's a play on words from the Torah. That's the methodology of Chazal, to get across certain ideas. That the that those who seek to learn by themselves without chavrusa, it's destined to fail. So perhaps that's clearly a representation over here, like a chavrusa. And the reason for that is because I think we all are familiar with that, is you may work on an idea by yourself, you may work it out with a chavrusa, but let's assume you work it out by yourself, but then you give it over. Doesn't mean you have to. You may reach a point I mean, at a certain point in my learning, I learned with Chavrusa. Because, you know, I was starting out, and just to go through the Gemara and to work it out, etc., it was much more effective with a Chavrusa. Now, when I reached the point where I was giving shiur, so I didn't have the, I hardly ever had the luxury of a Chavrusa. And so I had to do the preparing by myself. But I had to give it over. The idea of Chavrusa is that you put your ideas out there, and they have to be subjected to analysis, criticism, critique, and then you either reject them or you defend them. And you can't really grow in learning if it's just yourself. You're isolated, you know, you're not sharing it with anybody, and it's purely your own. And it's never, it's an impossibility. Maybe for certain great, you know, maybe for certain people that transcend, they're such great thinkers. But for ordinary mortals, and even for great minds, most of the great, you know, Torah scholars either learned b'chavrusa or they gave a shiur. Now, giving a shiur is probably better than chavrusa, because then you're putting it out there for students. Obviously, the students should be those who are free and trained to critique and disagree with you. Not like in many college, courses, the students, you know, their rights are kind of limited. They, if they challenge the professor too much, not all, I mean, but there are many of them that take it personally, and it's going to affect your grade. But that's not the way a Rebbe can function. The student must have absolute freedom to challenge and question. And that's the need to make sense and explain it to somebody else, and then to defend it when questions are raised. That's probably the best forum. If you want to really get on top of a subject, give a shiur on it. Because that's going to stimulate you to the highest degree to prepare. The knowledge that you're going to have to present it in front of people is going to force you to clarify it as much as you can. Just for ordinary emotional concerns. You don't want to make a fool out of yourself. You want to present well. And then in the give and take that takes place, you'll see afterwards, very rare that you walk in and you walk out, it's the exact same thing the way you had it. It undergoes modifications and changes. So that's the idea that we're talking about over here. That they're looking at one another means that they're engaged. And that would represent the idea of studying Torah together with another person. Now let's see what he has to say. That's a good idea, but let's see what this foreigner has to say. And the verse says, Ufnei Amish Alachiv, their faces are towards each other. For the process of giving these general principles and disseminating them require one to consider and concentrate towards the action of receiving these general principles that are removed from matter, since through them one attains the intended perfection. I don't know what he means. I'll read it again. For the process of giving these general principles and disseminating them requires one to consider and concentrate towards the action of receiving these general principles that are removed from matter, since through them one attains the intended perfection. The only thing that's coming to my mind is that one's face is towards the other, and he highlights the aspect of communicating and disseminating. So I'm just going to, this is what comes to mind. So in order to do so, you have to be cognizant of the other person. That is to say, a teacher can't just teach in the abstract. That's it. This is how I teach. And yeah, you find many teachers like that, that they may have good ideas, but the audience doesn't know what they're talking about. So you need someone else to sort of break it down and translate it to the audience. That could mean that not every great thinker is a great teacher. That's a different skill. So this person may not be really that great at teaching, even though the person is a great thinker. Or else, before you teach something, you have to have a sense of the audience. I need to know who I'm talking to. Am I talking to educated people? Am I talking to people that are totally ignorant in Torah? Am I talking to people from a different background that don't accept the premises of Torah? I mean, I have to know who I'm talking to and gear. It could be the same message, but you have to gear it towards the audience. Once I, then you do your best. I envision in my mind, I'm looking at, that's a real depiction. I'm envisioning in my mind the countenance, so to speak, of the one I'm going to be talking to and what they bring to the table. And when I give shiurim like that or classes, I can sort of anticipate. I know what's going to bug them about this, or I know what they're going to find difficult about that. So I'm going to look for a way to explain it that they can understand it. So that's what I'm getting. These are the words that I've just read, and that's the interpretation that I'm getting out of it.